Blog Talk Radio.
Good evening, everybody. Welcome to Desperate House Witches. My name is Raina Starr. Dorian Wallace has the night off. If you're new to Desperate House Witches, welcome. We are not a G, PG, or even, actually, we are an R-rated show. I learned this today. R stands for Raina's Rebellion. So guess what? That is our rating. So, if bad language, discussions about bodily functions, or any kind of cursing, or any kind of jokes that may be unseemly offend you, you may leave the room. Desperate House Witches is brought to you by The Angry Cauldron at theangrycauldron.com. They still have firecracker candles available, although a limited supply, so you better go get them. Angrycauldron.com. They also ship internationally. They're fabulous. And our other sponsor, the fantastic Wicked Witch herself, Dorothy Morrison, who has a spell of the month for July. Check it out on her Facebook page. WickedWitchStudios.com is the website. And tonight, I am very honored and excited, being the first Friday of the month, to have our pagan pundit himself, the amazing, talented Taliesin Govanin. Yay! How you doing?
Hey. I am doing mega groovy, getting ready to go to Starwood, and excited to sit down for a couple of hours, actually. So that's a good thing.
Something I'm sure you don't get to do a whole lot of.
Especially when I'm getting ready to go camping for a week with two kids, yes.
Oh, fun. Fun. Oh, my goodness. So, as I was telling you before, I have been pretty much out of the political loop. I have been laying low because I am just stressed out about it all. So catch me up, my friend. What is going on?
What is going on? Well, oh, goodness, try to pick things. When I was getting ready to call, I had my NBC News app open just to see if anybody had been indicted or resigned or anything like that in the last hour since I checked my messages last. That's how fast things move. Let's start out with Trump Care, the Republican plan to repeal and decimate the Affordable Care Act, is now it's not dead yet, but it's on life support, and Mitch McConnell is getting ready to trip over the electrical plug for the machine. Basically, he tried to come up with a plan that would please his entire caucus. The thing that people have got to remember when it comes to the Republicans in the Senate, they only have a 52-seat majority. The Democrats have 46 seats, but then they have two independents that caucus with them that are essentially a part of their coalition in the Senate. The Republicans have 52 seats, which means that in order to pass anything, they can only afford to lose two Republicans on any bill, because if it goes 50-50, then Mike Pence will come in and, summon Lucifer and, extend his pact to try to hurt as many people as possible and, break those ties in favor of the screw you party. But if they lose three votes, they're 49 and they lose. They lose 49-51. And so the Trump Care bill that Mitch McConnell sent his evil minions into hiding to go and craft, which was entirely made up of white men and older white men at that, they came out with something that everybody agreed on. that it sucked. I mean, literally, you couldn't find people who said they were excited about the bill. Immediately, you had multiple senators coming out against it. You had people like Ted Cruz, who I call Creepy Grandpa Munster, and Rand Paul, the man who has real hair that looks like a toupee, and people like that, saying that the bill just wasn't mean enough. It didn't kick people off their health care fast enough. And then you had people like Dean Heller out in Nevada, who is up for re-election next year in a state that Hillary Clinton won in the 2016 election, who's basically shitting turnips every time he's asked to take a vote on anything. I mean, you could ask this guy to vote to rename a post office, and he'd start to get nervous because his position is so precarious. He immediately said, no, this is going to kick 30,000 people in my state off health care, 24 million across the country, you know, or 22 to 24 million, depending on whose numbers you look at. And then you had people like Susan Collins up in Maine, who is really the only genuine moderate left in the Republican Party. It was a no-go for her because of the way that it slashed, basically eliminated Planned Parenthood funding, which funds, so, you know, in a lot of states, it funds up to 60% of all cancer screenings and mammograms and that sort of thing. Then you have people like Rob Portman in Ohio, who is trying to hug as close to the center as he possibly can. And there's just, you know, they thought the bill was too mean. And now, once Mitch McConnell decided to pull the bill from its planned floor vote, then you had more people coming out of the woodwork now that it was safe to say, oh, yeah, this sucks. And you have somewhere around 10, 11 Republicans who are saying that this bill is completely unacceptable. And this is a bill crafted by their own party. I've said it before. When you have a bunch of Republicans who were elected on their ability to say no to a Democratic president, they're not really that good at getting to yes. And they could be completely unified when they were saying no to the black guy. But now that the chance that the votes they cast could actually become law, now all of a sudden they're like, oh, yeah, this governing thing is hard. So Mitch McConnell is pretty much giving up. Well, McConnell's pretty much giving up on passing this bill because he figures he's already heard from the Freedom Caucus back in the House, and the Freedom Caucus in the House said, no, this bill isn't mean enough. So if the Senate passed it and sent it back to the House, then the House would have to vote on it all over again. And I just don't think McConnell's going to put it through. I think he's going to try to do a head fake on it and see if he can move on to tax reform, because the way that the Republicans in Congress have created their schedules, they really don't have a whole lot of legislating time left before the fiscal year runs out in the autumn, because they've been gone all week for the 4th of July recess. When they come back, they're only going to have 3 weeks to do all their business before they take the entire month of August off. And then when they come back from August, they're going to have a budget deadline staring them in the face. And if they don't pass a budget, then the government could shut down. And they don't have, you know, they tried blaming Barack Obama for shutting down the government in the past, and people didn't buy it. They're really not going to buy any of their excuses if the government shuts down under unified Republican control. And there's also a debt ceiling extension that's coming up that they're going to have to pass, or else the world economy takes a nosedive. So really, they've got 3 weeks to do everything. So now there are even some in Washington who are saying that tax reform, their plan to restructure the tax code to favor the wealthy even more, is already in trouble just because they don't have enough time. Healthcare, they wanted to get healthcare done quick and dirty to get it out of the way, and it's taken too long. And the fact that they're constantly dealing with Twitler's tweets and all the scandals coming out of the White House. And let's face it, Washington is not a city that multitasks very well. They tend to get focused on one thing at a time, and they've had so much drama and chaos going on around the executive branch that, you know, they just haven't been able to get anything done. So it's looking like increasingly that the year is going to finish up, and they will have spent the whole year doing very little other than passing bills to make sure that severely mentally ill people can still buy guns. How you doing, Steve Scalise? But anyway, that's about all that they've done since they've been in office.
Yeah.
So it's I used to think the Democrats were the masters of the circular firing squad, but the Republicans have taken what the Democrats could do, and they're just doing it umpteen times better when it comes to shooting themselves in the foot.
Yeah, I agree with you, but it still looks like the Democratic Party is searching for a leader and somebody that's actually going to be able to win in the upcoming series of elections next year. I mean, there's a lot
right.
going on, and I don't see anybody being necessarily or any group of people necessarily being groomed as these are who our front runners are going to be, except for maybe these whispers of perhaps a Biden-Booker ticket, which would be lovely.
Well, actually, I don't think that's going to happen. For one thing, Cory Booker has said some very stupid things defending Jared Kushner, so he's getting radioactive. He's not going to be a player in this time. He's going to have to take a few years to rehabilitate his image. And I really don't think Biden's going to do it. I think the person to watch right now is first-term senator from California, Kamala Harris. She was a district attorney for the city of San Francisco. She was the attorney general for the state of California. And ever since she's hit the Senate, she has been basically a progressive champion. She's opposed every single one of Trump's cabinet picks. She's been such a terror to people who are coming before the Senate Intelligence Committee that John McCain is trying to give these guys cover by shouting them down, because this woman's a professional prosecutor. She knows how to pull info out of people. And I follow her on Twitter. She is really striking all the right chords. She could literally be the person to unite the Hillary and Bernie wings of the party. So, well, we're going to have to keep an eye on that, because there are certain dead enders that Bernie Sanders is trying to disavow, but these are people who claim to be Bernie fans and basically are out gunning for any woman who could possibly dare to try to get a leadership position in the Democratic Party. But I really think that Kamala Harris could be that uniting figure. Just have to take a look and see how she handles herself over the next year and see how she aligns herself during the midterms. How hard does she go out and fight and work to try to get Democrats elected in other states? And how much does she work to try to get Democrats to take even more seats in the state of California? Because there are some Republican seats that could be vulnerable, because so many educated Republicans out in California are just not happy with the way that their representatives have been kowtowing to Herr Fuhrer. So keep an eye out for Kamala Harris. Elizabeth Warren is still a force. People are starting to seriously talk about Al Franken, and Sherrod Brown is always in the wings. So there's and also don't forget that Tom Perez and Keith Ellison are really, they're really burning things up at the Democratic National Committee. They are getting ready to roll out a true 50-state strategy for the midterms, because they really want to capitalize on the extreme unpopularity of the Republicans under Trump.
Yeah, well, that's not a real far way to go right now, is it?
You could see a Kamala Harris, Keith Ellison ticket in 2020, and that would be an all non-white ticket.
I would love that. I would love anything that is more diverse than what we have now. You know, we were
exactly
with Barack Obama, we were leaning into diversity. It looked like, maybe people have grown up some. And then, like a rubber band being snapped, it went back in the other direction of, regressive politics, abusive politics, abuse of power. You know, we went from a period of, this is great, something new and different, to, holy fuck, something new and different. Not good.
Well, I'm really genuinely hoping that the terror of tiny hands I'm really hoping that that's going to get through to some of what I call the fashionable whiners on the left, those people who wind up trying to pull the whole oh, both parties are the same, and you got to vote for a whack job, or else you're only part of the machine and all that stuff. I'm hoping that these people are starting to realize, God, you know, maybe if I hadn't voted for Jill Stein and I had voted for someone who could actually stop Trump, the country could be in a better place. I'll tell you, there was a thing that happened on a thread. It wasn't on my page. It was on a friend's page. But basically somebody had posted one of these, you know, what if I told you that the Democrats and the Republicans serve the same corporate masters and all that shit? And I went on there basically saying, you know, I think that we can definitely all agree, once you take a look at the Republican Party under Trump, that even the worst Democrat, like Bernie Sanders said, the worst Democrat is going to be better than the best Republican any day of the week. That's something that Bernie, that's paraphrasing Bernie Sanders right there. And this other guy, I'm not going to say who it is because I don't want to call him out on the radio or anything, but this other guy who has been on my friends list for like 3-4 years and has always been one of those, both parties are the same, they're all corporate sellouts, yada, yada, yada. He comes in and comments on my comment and said, you know, after taking a look at Trump, I've got to admit that you were right all along. The parties are not the same because there's no way that Trump ever could have gotten the Democratic nomination. I just about fell out of, but I just about fell out of my seat because this is somebody who every political interaction has basically come back to them saying that all Democrats and Republicans are just the same and it's just a label thing and yada, yada, yada. But this guy came in and said, no, you're right. The parties are different. Yeah, I mean, you know, he's like, I may not be a big fan of the Democrats, but damn, they never would have nominated anybody as crazy as Trump. So, I mean, just little bits of daylight, little bits of daylight dawning in people's brains. If we can have that happen enough, then we could really put together a coalition that could really, again, affect some majorly positive change in the country.
I agree. That's a wonderful thing, you know, but I'm not so pie in the sky that I don't think Democrats don't serve corporate, you know, interests. Of course they do. That's how they have to make money. If anybody understands the process of fundraising and what it takes to actually make things happen, maintain your seat, I mean, they are told from day one that they have to get on the phone and start making phone calls to be supported. You know, and those contributions go to various things as well, you know, to promote bills, to write legislature. It doesn't all just happen by magic where, you know, we're paying for everything. It actually costs a lot more than people realize, and it's not enough for just their government salaries to keep them going. The expenses that have to be paid, you know,
just to run campaigns,
for both, just to run campaigns is out of sight. You see what it costs to run a presidential campaign, the millions and millions of dollars involved in that. I'm not saying that the, you know, the House and Senate are the same on the same level, but we saw
a Senate race is still going to set you back about $5-6 million, and you've got 6 years. You basically have to raise $1 million a year just to be competitive.
It's really, I mean, the money in politics is pervasive. I would love to run a campaign. There was one point in time where I wanted to run for the House to replace Sue Myrick, and I was told by the party head I was a great candidate, I was ready to go. The money wasn't there, and the lines had been redistricted so that I could not win. It was so gerrymandered at the time that a Democrat, no matter who the Democrat was, there was no shot. So, I mean, it's constantly an uphill battle. If you think that serving in the House or Senate is a cushy job, there are certain perks. Oh, don't get me wrong. Free health care?
Right.
Yeah, for life. Fantastic. But don't think that it's all pie in the sky on that either. It's a hard fucking job.
It is. And then, you know, and you can tell the people who think it's going to be easy because they're the people who get in there and don't get anything done. I mean, but one thing I want to say about the money in politics is that there is an incredible chance for change now because of the fact that Tom Perez and Keith Ellison are wanting to ramp up the Democrats' robust online fundraising that they have during presidential years. They want to get that going for every single election cycle. And let me tell you something, 90% of Hillary Clinton's money that she raised came from small donations of $200 or less, mainly raised online directly from constituents. If they could start doing that kind of fundraising for every House race, for every Senate race, they could literally tell the lobbyists to go jump in the lake. We don't need your money because we've got all these people who are donating to be a part of the campaign, real citizen politics. And even as things are right now, one of the big differences between Democrats and Republicans is that if you work hard enough, you can usually shame a Democratic representative or senator into doing the right thing. We saw that a few years ago when there were people trying to get Lawrence Summers be appointed the head of the Federal Reserve, and this guy was way cushy with Wall Street. And basically, there was a big grassroots campaign to shame the senators into opposing him, and it worked. We got Janet Yellen instead of Larry Summers, the first woman, by the way, to ever run the Federal Reserve. So Democrats, if there's enough of a concerted campaign, you can shame them into doing the right thing. Republicans, on the other hand, will still do what they wanted to do in the first place, and they go around telling everybody that's what people really wanted anyway. Those people who were protesting were just a noisy minority. So, that's a big difference. It's like a Democrat may start to back a bad bill, but if you really get organized and really keep the grassroots up and running, then you can shame them into doing the right thing. And if you wind up donating money in $5 or $10 increments to candidates you believe in, these people can become competitive. The thing is that we need to take the incredible energy and drive that Democrats display during presidential years, and we need to do that every single election. And let me tell you, Trump being on the TV every night, it isn't a bad motivator, I'll tell you that much.
I agree with that wholeheartedly. It drives me nuts.
Oh, and another thing, too, is that you take a look at Virginia's having their statewide elections this year. They always happen the year after a presidential race, their off-year elections. And 4 years ago, something like 30-35% of all the seats in the state assembly held by Republicans, those Republicans ran for re-election unopposed, either because the Democratic Party had a hard time finding people who were willing to run. This time, there's only about 8% unopposed, and they want to go to 0% unopposed by the time the filing deadlines are done. So contesting every seat is a first step, because there's no way a Democrat can win a seat if no Democrat runs for it. So
right.
Virginia is experiencing, and I mean, they're getting good candidates asking about running in seats that haven't had a Democrat run there in 20 years, and they're getting two or three people saying, hey, I'd be interested in running. Here's my resume. So it's, definitely the whole spirit of resistance is inspiring people to say, no, even if I run and lose, I'm still going to oppose that Cheeto faced, rare shit given in the White House every way I can. So, and also that's also Tom Perez and Keith Ellison are doing a big bit on candidate recruitment. These two are the best 1-2 punch that I've ever seen in the DNC chair. And, literally, you got Tom Perez, the most progressive member of Obama's cabinet, and Keith Ellison, who is a black Muslim sitting in Congress, an incredible progressive voice. I mean, these guys are just tearing it up.
Well, that makes me feel better, because I was really disappointed. I knew that winning the Georgia seat was going to be tough for Ossoff. I knew that was going to be hard. I mean, we came closer this time in Georgia than we have in, 30 years, 40 years? I mean, it was a real run for the money on that. So, while everybody's like, this just tells you that people are pro-Trump and this is the way people want it. No, you got to look at it from the other side of it. There was great improvement in voter turnout where there hadn't been before from the Democrats. But my fear is that while Republicans fall in line, Democrats, for whatever reason, still feel like they have to fall in love. And this is where
right.
we run into trouble when we can't all unite behind a candidate, no matter what the race is for, whether it's, you know, a Senate seat or a House seat or president itself. So what are we going to do to get people more motivated and stay motivated?
Well, one of the things to remember about the Georgia seat, too, is that that Georgia seat, that had national exposure, national attention, millions of dollars pouring in on both sides of the race. And the thing is that that kind of erased some of the voter enthusiasm gap that initially favored the Democrats, because Republicans who may not have been bothered to turn out to vote because they weren't happy with what was going on in Washington ultimately did because of how much attention that race got. So the sheer amount of media attention that that race got kind of erased the voter enthusiasm advantage that the Democrats had going into that. But another thing to remember about that, and also in 2018, there's going to be lots of races that get zero national attention, and that's where the enthusiasm mm-hmm. gap is going to absolutely slaughter Republican candidates. But another thing to remember, too, the same night that the Georgia special election happened, there was a special election in South Carolina. And
yeah.
both seats, the Republicans won, but they saw a 17-point drop. In other words, the Republicans who ran for those seats in 2016 before they got picked to be on the SS Trump tannic of an administration, these guys back in November won these seats by like 20, 22 points. The Republicans who won these seats in the special election last month won them by 7 points. You saw a 13-point drop in those seats, even Georgia that had all of that incredible focus from the national media. Let me tell you, the Democrats need 24, 25 seats to retake the House. If you see
yeah.
a 17-point swing, if you see a 17-point swing across the country from Republicans toward Democrats next year, they're not going to win 25 seats. They're going to win 100 seats and easily be the biggest House majority that anybody has seen in the last 100 years. So, and also the South Carolina seat where the Republican won by 7 points, that had zero national attention. That had almost no money spent on it, and the Republicans
That's
went
true.
From winning by 22 points to winning by 7 points. So literally, you know, while the Republicans on TV were saying, oh, yeah, we're relieved that, you know, Ossoff lost and all that stuff, they're still shitting turnips. And they're still – I mean, they're still scared shitless, literally, over what's going on. And that's also a big reason why you're not seeing a whole lot of representatives or senators trying to lobby their states to turn over their voting data the way that Trump's voter suppression panel wants them to do. So, you know, they're running scared, and they're not wanting to stick their necks out on jack shit. So.
Well, that's a plus, definitely.
Oh, yeah,
so,
there's another great failure that we could talk about, Trump's so-called
please.
Voter Integrity Commission.
What is that?
Have you heard about that?
I have not. I've been keeping myself out of the loop.
Well, you know, after Trump lost the popular vote by 3 million votes, he came out and said that he would have won the popular vote if he didn't have 3 to 5 million illegal votes cast by illegal immigrants. Yeah, that was one of the
so
things
I
he
heard.
Said after
yeah.
the election was done. Well, a few
right.
months ago, he signed an executive order to create the Presidential Commission on Voting Integrity. And he put in charge of it not only Mike Pence, but this guy named Chris Kobach from Kansas, who is the nation's expert on suppressing African-American votes. This is a guy who tries to come up with every legal way he can to keep people from voting. And this is the vice chair of this, I call it the Voter Suppression Commission, because basically what Trump wants is he wants a sideshow, but he wants to try to create some sort of central place in Washington where instead of state to state doing voter suppression efforts, this way they could do it nationwide, even in states controlled by Democrats. Well, wow. The Voting Commission sent out a letter to all 50 states and the District of Columbia asking for all their voter registration data. They wanted first and last name, birth date, last four numbers of their social, every election that they voted on, and how they voted, if there's a record of that since 2006. Notice right when Democrats started winning national elections again. And home addresses and telephone numbers and all of this stuff. They wanted them to send all this information in to this commission. And as of this date, between states outright saying no or other states saying, well, you know, you can have the stuff that's publicly available on our website, but nothing else, 49 states have all told them to go fuck themselves. Republican states, Democratic states. In fact, the Secretary of State for the state of Louisiana, or was it Mississippi, said that basically they can go jump in the Gulf of Mexico. That was his answer when they asked him for this information. And that's a far-right Republican. So, you know, it's like it's impressive. Well, also, that's the thing. You know, you get a lot of these Republican operative types, and they are basically, you know, they're very libertarian, but they're also very paranoid. So, you know, it's you know, they don't want the government having all of that information.
I don't blame them.
It's impressive.
Because couldn't this be used? Couldn't this information be used for even more voter intimidation?
Yeah. Okay. Could you repeat that? I was just had to give my wife my dinner order. She's running out to buy us food. What was that?
Oh, I'm sorry. I was asking if the information that they're asking for would just really be used for more voter suppression and intimidation.
Yeah. Hold on. I couldn't hear the question again.
What
was that again? I'm sorry. I'm on the back porch.
You're
in my bedroom, but okay.
You can go ahead and play. Did you place your order? You're good.
Yes, I did.
Not a problem.
Yes, I did.
Okay. So my question was, wouldn't this information gathering that the commission has requested, wouldn't that just be used for further voter intimidation and suppression?
Well, that's obviously what they want to do, but, you know, that's obviously what they want to do, but the states aren't cooperating. So even states that have done and for one thing that's happening is that states are starting to get slapped down by the courts. The federal courts are ruling a lot of their voter ID laws and their gerrymanders unconstitutional because of just how good a job they did at targeting African-American voters. So it's like, you know, so, you know, even in states where they've done, you know, they've bent over backwards to try to do this stuff, you know, it's kind of like they just, you know, most Republicans don't like Trump. And also the fact that Chris Kobach keeps doing these things and he keeps getting sued and he's lost every lawsuit that people have sued him for voter suppression that he's done as the Secretary of State for the state of Kansas. It doesn't really inspire confidence in them. So even Republicans are saying, oh, hell no. So yet another attempt at Trump doing something that's going down like Paris Hilton at a college kegger.
Wow.
Oh, yeah.
So, you know, lately I've been wondering, because no one's really said anything about him, but where has Mike Pence been lately? He's really sort of maintaining a low profile, it seems.
Well, Mike Pence has formed his own super PAC, which is the first sitting vice president to ever do so. Because I think some people are around him are anticipating that he could be the incumbent trying to run in 2020. But also, he just hired a high-priced defense lawyer who specializes in political scandals. So that's some of the stuff that he's been doing lately. And he's also desperately trying to cover his ass because people are starting to ask him questions about Mike Flynn. I mean, I've talked about it on the show before, the fact that Mike Pence tried to say that he had no idea that Mike Flynn was a lobbyist for Turkey before the news stories hit the wire, even though Mike Pence's lawyers and a congressional committee told Mike Pence when he was the head of the Trump transition team that, oh, yeah, by the way, Michael Flynn looks like he's lobbying for Turkey. This might be a security problem. And so he's trying to dodge questions on that. He's really trying desperately to keep his head down because anybody who sticks their head up to talk about anything winds up getting asked questions that they'd really rather not answer. And now that he's actually got a decent lawyer, way better than any of the lawyers who are working for Trump, he's also begun to not talk a whole lot because any good lawyer is going to tell you, say as little as possible. Because the less you say, the less it can be held against you.
And that makes sense. But I'm not familiar with this type of situation where the vice president runs against the president. Is that kind of new territory that he would be stepping into?
Well, actually, what I think his people are anticipating is that Trump's not going to last in office till 2020 and that Pence would wind up becoming president when Trump left town. And so they want to start raising money for a possible Mike Pence 2020 campaign, although I actually don't think that that would even happen. I think that Bob Mueller would probably wind up taking out Pence first because the special prosecutor, Bob Mueller, knows he's getting to know just how dirty Trump and Pence are. And, it'd be a lot easier to take down a sitting vice president than a sitting president, and especially you don't want to try to take down two sitting presidents in a row. So I think that what's going to happen once indictments start coming down is I think Pence is going to get pegged because don't forget that Mike Pence was chosen for the ticket as a vice presidential candidate by Paul Manafort, a guy who has no less than five different FBI investigations targeting him right now, some of which go back a decade or more. And this is a guy who got Mike Pence on the ticket. So if you're following the money and the fact that Mike Pence just hired a guy who is a $2,000 an hour lawyer, and Mike Pence is not made of money. He's not a millionaire. He hangs out with millionaires and gets millionaires to fund his campaigns, but he himself is not that rich. So he's already said that that taxpayer money isn't paying for his lawyer and that his PAC isn't going to pay for his lawyer, but people are wondering how the hell he's paying for his lawyer. So if they're following money trails, they could run across him, but just taking down Mike Flynn could wind up spilling over onto the vice president as well. And I really think that what would probably happen is that if Pence is sufficiently dirty for Mueller to indict him, Mueller would probably go to him with a deal saying, listen, if you resign the vice presidency and pledge to never run for office again, I won't put you in jail. There's plenty of prosecutors who have weighed the public good in that way and figuring that, having to resign in disgrace from the vice presidency would be a pretty good level of punishment for whatever he's done. And then Trump would have to pick a new vice president that would have to be confirmed by 2/3 of both houses of Congress. Well, in order to do that, you'd have to get somebody who Democrats and Republicans would both like. And so I think they'd probably wind up with somebody like John McCain or somebody like that, a crowd pleaser who everybody in the Senate and the House pretty much likes. And then they could go after Trump and we'd be left with a President McCain instead of a President Pence. Not my first choice, but a hell of a lot better than Trump, Pence, or Paul Ryan.
Well, at least McCain understands government, which is more than I can say for the person currently occupying the office. So,
and he understands how not to go to war, that you don't torture people, little things like that.
Right. There are some other things that I can give him some credit for, absolutely. But I don't see that as – I don't see it as being something that actually happens when we're still, sitting on our hands waiting for something to happen with Trump. Are we any closer to using the I word around him or what?
Well, we just had our first piece of evidence of collusion with the Russians that reaches into the current White House. There's a guy named Peter White. He was a Republican operative for a long time. he got his name in the Republican Party digging up dirt on Bill Clinton. He was the guy who was paying off the Arkansas State Troopers to say that they used to guard Bill Clinton when he had his extramarital affairs when he was governor of Arkansas. Peter Smith is the guy who was behind Troopergate. And he basically specializes in opposition research and trashing Democrats, especially those named Clinton. Well, last year, right, after the news report started to surface that the Russians had hacked the Democratic National Committee and John Podesta, Hillary Clinton's campaign manager, Peter Smith was wondering if those same Russians ever managed to hack Hillary's private email server. Now, that's a funny thing. People who kept raising a fuss about Hillary's private email server, that was like the only server in Washington that never got hacked. The DNC got hacked. The RNC got hacked. The Russians just never did anything with what they stole from the RNC because they wanted Trump to win. But the DNC, the RNC, the FBI, the CIA's computers got hacked. Hillary's email server was the only one that was pretty secure. But they didn't know that at the time. So Peter Smith put together this group of people, computer experts and Russian experts, trying to reach out to Russian hackers to see if they had any stuff off of Hillary Clinton's private email server that he could then funnel to the Trump campaign. And when he was trying to recruit people to join this little business enterprise, he was sending out documents boasting about how not only he was connected to the Trump campaign, but he was in direct communication with Mike Flynn, Mike Flynn's son, as well as Steve Bannon and Kellyanne Conway. And these are all ways that he could get Hillary's emails into the hands of the Trump campaign team. So he was keeping the organization technically separate from the Trump campaign so they wouldn't be liable for campaign financial disclosure laws. But
right,
he was boasting in his recruitment documents that he was in with the top echelons of the Trump campaign. So if this – now, Peter Smith can't be questioned anymore because 10 days after he talked to a reporter from the Wall Street Journal, he suddenly died. So, but the guy, one of the guys that he tried to recruit is on the record with his name as talking about this, having seen these documents, having talked with people in this enterprise and them boasting about how they were working hand in hand with the Trump campaign. And if this story pans out, then you're going to see that there was an attempt at collusion with people who are going to feed the information directly to the Trump campaign. And I think this is also going to bear out. This is the first evidence that a lot of people have kind of theorized that Mike Flynn was the contact guy between the Russians and the Trump campaign, because Mike Flynn had his own cozy relationship with Vladimir Putin. And this is the first piece of evidence that starts to bear that out. So you can bet that all this information is in the hands of the special prosecutor, and they are following things wherever they may go. As a matter of fact, the special prosecutor just hired an attorney to work on the case who is fluent in Russian. So they obviously
wow.
think they're going to be looking at a lot of Russian language source materials in the very near future.
That's crazy. I mean, a lot of this fervor has died down recently, you know, more talking about the G20 summit and everything else that's going on in the world. So, you know, I wonder, and, you know, in my head, I worry, gee, has interest in this been lost? Are we losing ground here? But it sounds like, from what you're describing, behind the scenes, things are very much in motion, and they're just waiting to gather all of their evidence until they can actually present a case. Do we have any more of a time? Oh, I'm sorry. Go ahead.
I would say the way Bob Mueller works, he is a meticulous person. He is going to build an airtight case. As a matter of fact, one of his other hires is somebody who specializes in prosecuting terrorists and organized crime figures. And this woman has never lost a case in her life because she's an expert at making sure that every case, every indictment she's ever brought is airtight. So that's the kind of job that Bob Mueller is going to do. He's going to be meticulous. He is going to be patient. He's going to follow the evidence wherever it goes. And any indictments that he hands down are going to be built around a case that is so airtight that literally you could fill it up with water and there wouldn't be a single drip coming out of it. And another thing that just happened that didn't get a lot of play in the news is a guy named Felix Sater. Now, Felix Sater is a finance guy, but he's also been in cozy with the Russian mob in the past. He was involved in a joint venture between the Sicilian mob in New York and the Russian mafia that was a stock swindling scheme. And he wound up turning state's evidence and helping to put a lot of these guys in jail. Well, he's continued doing his own business that isn't entirely on the up and up ever since then. And one of the business partners he had was a man named Donald Trump. In fact, for years, he carried a business card. As recently as 3 years ago, Felix Sater carried a business card that identified him as a consultant for the Trump Organization. And what he did is he used to put together foreign financing for Trump's projects, because after Donald Trump declared bankruptcy the fourth time, no American bank would loan money to him. They just considered him a terrible risk because he doesn't like to pay his loans back. And so Felix Sater's job for Trump was securing outside funding for Trump properties. The problem is that some of this outside funding came in the form of money laundering schemes. The Trump Taj Mahal Casino in New Jersey was busted right before Trump announced in 2015, was busted and fined over $10 million for Russian money laundering. And the Trump Soho Tower in New York was going down and was almost abandoned as a project before a Russian oligarch pumped hundreds of millions of dollars into the project and saved it. That's one of the things that Felix Sater did for Donald Trump, was to get this Russian money into his real estate ventures. Well, word has just come down that Felix Sater has flipped, and he is now a cooperating witness for the FBI and the special prosecutor in money laundering cases that they're pursuing. So one of Trump's business buddies has just flipped on him.
I wonder if they're going to tap his ghostwriter or his co-writer for the autobiography that was done. That guy can't stand him. And I wonder if he's got any information that they're going to find usable, too.
Yeah. Well, Tony Schwartz has pretty much given up everything he knows on Trump to the media ever since Trump announced for the presidency. But the interesting thing is that another person that Bob Mueller has added to the investigation is a lawyer who specializes in flipping witnesses to testify against their bosses. This is the guy who flipped Sammy the Bull Gravano and got John Gotti put away. So this guy is an expert in flipping witnesses. And this guy had, about 4 weeks ago, just joined Bob Mueller's team in the special prosecutor's office.
Wow. Ooh. That sounds pretty well loaded. That's pretty amazing.
One of the ways that they do this is they wind up finding something they can prosecute the person they want to flip. They find something that one of their family members has done. Like, for example, Mike Flynn's son is up to his eyeballs in some very questionable stuff. So if they wanted to flip Mike Flynn to testify against Donald Trump or anybody else in the White House, what they do is they find something that his son did that was illegal and go to Mike Flynn and say, listen, we don't want to prosecute your son. We really don't want to. But if you want us to stop prosecuting your son, you got to give us something. You know, you got to give us something that is valuable enough for us to let this little case go. And that's generally how they flip people. That's how the one guy flipped Sammy the Bull Gravano, is that he found that his wife was involved in some very questionable real estate deals and basically said, if you don't want your wife to spend the next 10 years in a federal prison, you're going to talk. And that was enough. So because, you know, a lot of these bad guys who do these illegal things wind up involving their family members, because a lot of times their family members are the only ones that they can really, truly trust to have their back on things. But then their family members wind up doing shit that's illegal that they could go to prison for. And that's just one of the tools that these prosecutors can use to flip witnesses to start testifying against their bosses.
Wow. It's amazing. All kinds of ways to get people to squeal.
Oh, yeah. That,
well, that's comforting.
Oh, yeah.
I like hearing that. It makes me feel like things are still happening.
Oh, things are still happening on a regular basis. It's just not all being covered on the evening news. Because, you know, what Trump does is, like, right before the story about the Peter Smith thing and the collusion reaching into the White House, right, you know, when the Wall Street Journal was preparing this story, they call the White House and say, do you have any comments? What that does is it tips the White House off that a big story is coming and what the story is generally going to be about. So you notice right before that story was about to be published, Donald Trump decides to launch his Twitter war against Mika Brzezinski from Morning Joe. And so that's all
yeah.
the media was talking about when the Peter Smith story broke. That's what the media was talking about, except Rachel Maddow. Rachel Maddow said, I see what you're doing here. It's not going to work. Let's talk about this story. So Rachel is still, you know, pursuing things, and she's not going to be distracted by the latest bright, shiny object that Trump tosses out on Twitter.
Well, I just heard recently that someone tried to give her falsified documents.
Yes, yes, and somebody, it had to be somebody inside the NSA, because they used documents as a template to forge this phony document that nobody had at the time. They were documents that were part of another case that was about to be published, but the story hadn't been published yet. So they basically took those documents and reconfigured them to put out a phony document trying to get Maddow to bite. Basically, this is one of the ways that governments fight back against the press, is they try to feed them an obviously false story, and then if they run with that false story, then they pull out all the info that shows that story was false, they crucify them over that, and then that makes people not quite so quick to pursue the story anymore. That's what happened with Dan Rather back during
yep.
the 2000 campaign about George W. Bush's National Guard service. Now, all the information that Rather had was actually factually correct, but the CBS News report relied on a document that wasn't real. And that was the excuse they used to bury the rest of the story and to go after Rather and CBS News and all that stuff. So that's another thing that they're trying now, but Rachel Maddow's team is just too sharp to be fooled by this. And now every news organization is on full alert to make sure that they verify every single scintilla of information before they publish it. So basically the entire enterprise is now, the entire operation to try to get the press to report something false, and that cover's just been blown. Thanks to Rachel.
Well, that's good. But I do also want to ask you, you know, this against the media stance that the administration has taken, you know, I hear from a lot of whispers and, you know, talk in offices and things like that, where some people are actually buying into this, the media is evil and they just want to tear down this president because the media is full of liberals, which I actually don't find to necessarily be true.
No.
Are you hearing the
same
thing?
Just look at Hillary's emails. Look at Hillary's email server. I mean, that was a nothing burger of a story that the media flogged relentlessly. If the media was really all that liberal, they would have treated it as the non-story that it was.
True, but a lot of people on the other side are feeling somewhat emboldened to say that the media is false and that CNN is false and that, you know, all news outlets are false, which is kind of frightening. This is how dictators get their foothold. You know, you downplay everything that the media tries to present, which is truthful, and they want you to only believe what comes out of their mouths. As a matter of fact, wasn't there a point in time where someone from the White House actually said, you can't believe anything but what you hear from this room from the president?
Oh, well, you know, the White House press secretaries always take that attitude. But one thing I'll tell you, the right wing has not liked the media for years, mainly because reality, as Stephen Colbert said, has a well-known liberal bias. But outside of that media, outside of that right-wing bubble, even, no matter how bad the approval ratings for the media are in general, they're way better than the Republicans in Congress or Donald Trump. And the one audience that does listen to the media and does get nervous when the media reports things are Republicans in Congress. I mean, let's face it, Donald Trump going after Morning Joe, Joe Scarborough, and Mika Brzezinski was ultimately stupid, yeah. Because I'll tell you, that is the one morning show that everybody in Washington watches, especially Republicans. Republicans don't watch Fox and Friends. Only Donald Trump watches Fox and Friends. Because Republicans know that that's just theater.
Right. Obviously.
Whereas Joe Scarborough was a Republican member of the House of Representatives. He came in with Newt Gingrich's crowd in the 90s. This is a guy who has long-standing relationships with the entire Republican power structure. They're friends. They hang out together all the time. Joe has some incredibly good sources inside the White House that talk to him all the time. And picking a fight with that particular cable news show, big loser, because that just because they're going after the one news source that Republicans in Congress actually trust, and that's Joe Scarborough.
Yeah, well, I found it interesting that, you know, people were so outraged about this comment about a facelift when this president has said so many horrific things, much more horrific than that comment. But all of a sudden, people started to just jump on the story and gave it a lot more traction than I imagined it was capable of getting. I was a bit surprised. It's like, oh, it's okay that he can talk about, you know, moving on somebody like a bitch and grabbing her pussy and trying to fuck her. And, you know, he could say all of these things. He could insult Megyn Kelly. He can insult all these women, you know,
right.
Women that technically worked for him at one point, you know, beauty pageant contestants and say all these terrible things and then make these disgusting comments about if she wasn't my daughter, I'd date her, or and looking at a prepubescent girl and saying in 10 years I'll be dating her. I mean, but the facelift is what freaks people out. I'm like, really? This is what got your attention? I was just astounded by all that.
Well, I mean, that's the thing, too. It's all talking about choosing your target. When you're dealing with the Neanderthal Republicans, you got to pick your target. And, I mean, there are plenty of Republicans. You know, you're not going to find a more friendly place for establishment Republicans on cable news. Outside of Fox, you're not going to find a more friendly place, generally, than Morning Joe. And Mika Brzezinski, you know, it's one thing when Donald Trump talks about these nameless, faceless women or this sort of thing. But when you start attacking somebody like Mika Brzezinski, for one thing, the daughter of Zbigniew Brzezinski, one of the most respected guys in Washington for the past 60 years, who just passed away. And Mika is somebody that all of these Republicans know. They know her personally. She's been to their houses. She's hung out with their families. They know her as a friend, as a confidant. It's just one of these things that is especially true for Republicans. Republicans tend not to care about anybody being mistreated until it's someone they know. Like in my state of Ohio, Rob Portman, the senator, was a staunch anti-gay rights, anti-gay marriage advocate until his son came out to him. And then he all of a sudden started to support gay marriage and all that stuff because it was personal. It was in the family. Well, when it comes to the Washington family, Mika Brzezinski is like all of these guys' sister. You know, that's how well they know her. And so, Trump could have decided to go after anybody. He could have went after anybody on NBC. He could have went after Casey Hunt. He could have went after Katie Turr. He could have went after Andrea Mitchell, for God's sake. But going after Mika, that's like going after somebody's sister, somebody's cousin, you know, somebody that everyone knows. And yummy. My wife just brought a 12-pack of beer. That's yummy. But this is going after somebody that this makes it personal. This brings it home. This is no longer that nameless, faceless woman from some pageant somewhere. You know, I mean, that's a big difference between the left and the right. Liberals, we think that nobody should be treated this way. Therefore, this type of stuff makes us upset. With Republicans, you got to bring it home. You got to bring the horror to someone they know personally, and then they start to get how bad it is. And that's what Trump did going after Mika. He went after everybody's kid sister in Washington, and he's burned a lot of bridges. Let me tell you something. When it comes down to getting time with, you know, getting a senator or a member of the House to come by the White House for a dinner party, you don't talk to the men. You talk to their wives. You have Melania call up the wife of some Republican senator or member of the House and say, oh, I certainly hope you two will come to this dinner party. We'd really like to, you know, have a get together and see what we can do in the next year in Congress. It's done like wife to wife. And now you've just pissed off all of these Republican wives. Because let's face it, there's not a lot of actual Republican women in their congressional delegation, but you've just pissed off every wife in Washington by going after Mika. And that is, again, a really stupid thing. Really not worth the distraction, because a lot of people wouldn't understand just how bad the Peter Smith story was. But they get this. So, you know, it's, again, nuking more bridges. And it actually got the 25th Amendment trending on Twitter. And every Republican, every politician in Washington pays attention to Twitter.
That is astounding. You know, we get the New York Times here, and this past Sunday they had a full-page spread of the Constitution because most people don't even know what's in it, which I find incredible, but true.
Oh, yeah.
So I loved it. I actually saved it because I thought it was brilliant. And, you know, people are just not in touch with what government is, what government does.
Yeah.
All, you know, we had a response from somebody we worked with as far as, you know, what they thought of the current administration, who they had voted for, and said, we don't care what he says or does. Our side won. That boggles my mind that could be your only focal point, your side. Your side is against you, sir. You don't seem to understand.
Right.
And it blows me away when people finally started learning what the ACA was and that they were going to lose their health care even though they had voted for Trump. It's like, how could you not know what this was? It has been everywhere. It has been discussed in churches. It has been discussed in the streets. It has been discussed in homes. I mean, unless you really are living under a rock, how did you not know?
Well, because they got their news from right-wing sources. I mean, you'd literally have people saying, I don't care if they get rid of Obamacare. I got my health care through the ACA. That's how disconnected they are.
It's just astounding.
Now, you want to talk about funny. I was going to say, you want to talk about funny real quick. You're talking about them printing the Constitution. Did you see, over the July 4th weekend, NPR tweeted the Declaration of Independence like they do every year. Well, this year, a bunch of Trump supporters got mad because they thought that NPR was attacking Trump. Declaration of Independence. Did the War of the Worlds next and see what Trump, the Trumpkins thought about that.
But speaking of the ACA, so we were supposed to have a vote before the July 4th break. We
didn't happen.
One.
Yep.
Didn't happen. Doesn't look like it's going to happen this week. Are they?
Nope.
My understanding is that there is the support for this repeal is less and less as time goes by. So.
Oh yeah.
Are they actually going to be able to do this or not? And if not, then what happens?
Well, that's the thing, is that Mitch McConnell, he, you know, Paul Ryan talked like this to try to threaten his caucus. But Mitch McConnell is talking about this as a matter of fact, that if their Trump care bill doesn't get passed, they're going to have to work with the Democrats to try to fix aspects of the ACA, which basically means that you actually get fixes to some of the problems in the ACA without any of the other stuff that goes along with it. So the fact of the matter
isn't that going to piss off the base, though? Because it seems like the really hardcore Republicans really want it to be a lot harsher than the bill actually is now. They actually preferred the first pass of this. So how do you get people on board with enough support from either side if you're having to walk
right.
this tightrope?
Well,
is there a way to get anything done?
Well, one of the things that happened with the base that improved the ACA's numbers, as a matter of fact, the ACA just hit 51% approval rating for the first time ever. One of the things that actually helped the ACA was when Republicans decided that they were going to try to mess with it, they went after Medicaid. And people started to realize just how much Medicaid even helps people who aren't covered by the insurance. Not just the figures of half of all births in this country are paid for by Medicaid, 40% of all children are covered by Medicaid, but also for a lot of these middle class and upper middle class Republicans, they suddenly realize that their parents or grandparents who are in nursing homes, a lot of that gets paid for by Medicaid as well. And so by going sure. after Medicaid, all of a sudden it caused a large chunk of Republicans to realize, oh, maybe we shouldn't fuck with this. I mean, literally, some of the insiders who were talking candidly off the record were saying that it wasn't that Mitch McConnell had three no votes or four no votes. It was that if you'd actually put this bill up for a vote, you could have seen as low as five yes votes out of the Republican caucus for this shit sandwich of a bill. So what they're going to do is, you know, basically they're going to rely on the most hardcore right-wing white nationalist racist base are going to be mollified by the fact that Trump is in office. Their great white hope is in office. And they figure that they'll be able to do things that please their college-educated Republican base, the little bit more moderate types. They could do stuff that please them and keep them happy and keep them with the Republican Party, even though the college-educated Republican base, that section of the base, hates Trump with a passion. So they figure that Trump will keep the yokels in line, and they can try to use ACA fixes as a way of keeping their college-educated Republicans with the party and not let them be driven away by Trump. So it's really a really delicate balancing game that they're trying to do here. And ultimately, you know, it's basically all the Republicans are going to go home. The conservatives are going to go home and say, yeah, well, the bill that they gave us wasn't conservative enough. And the moderates are going to go home and say, well, the bill they gave us is just way too mean. I would have kicked way too many of you people off your health care. So basically, by letting the bill go down to defeat, they're hoping to try to turn that into a win. It's a dicey situation, though, because they've been running on repeal for 7 years. And once they actually get the chance, they begin to realize, yeah, this isn't as easy as we were saying it was going to be when there was no chance of any of our bills passing. And as a matter of fact, the funny thing now is now you've got some of the most hardcore right-wingers in the Senate saying, well, let's just repeal Obamacare and we'll replace it later, which basically instead of 22 million people kicked off of health insurance, it would kick 32 million people off of health insurance. And the fact, you know, and that is such a non-starter. Not even Mitch McConnell will touch that one. So basically the different factions are posturing. They're going to try to play it up to the people at home. But this is just, I mean, this legislative session has been an unmitigated disaster for the Republican Party. They literally have no idea of how to govern. So and for anybody in their home districts who actually care about that sort of thing, this is not good for them. They're going to try to spin it into a positive, but it's not good.
Right. What about the reinstitution of parts of the travel ban?
Well, the Supreme Court let parts of it go in, basically, but the things like if you've got a job in the U.S. or if you've got family in the U.S., then you can't be banned. And they're basically going to kick this down the line until they actually hear the case in September. I really think that it'll probably wind up getting struck down in a 5-4 decision because the court as it sits right now, ideologically, is kind of the same as it was when Scalia was on the bench, and this is the kind of thing that would usually go down 5-4 in those days. But one of the things that's happening, too, is that it's actually improving people's opinions of immigration because all of a sudden you've got hospitals saying to their communities, well, we're going to have to delay surgeries because these highly trained doctors from the Middle East can't come here to work anymore for the time being. So it's, you know, it's going to backfire on the Trump people eventually, but you know, it's basically a watered down version of the travel ban. And if the Trump people really do nothing as they've been doing, the greatest argument against it is going to say, hey, they said they needed this time to improve their vetting procedures. They haven't done anything. And that right there will be the death knell for it because banning people just because they happen to be Muslim is clearly unconstitutional in a way that even John Roberts wouldn't be able to get behind.
Wow. Speaking of John Roberts and the Supreme Court, there were rumblings recently that another more liberal member of the Supreme Court was thinking of retiring. What kind of situation are we looking at as far as another Trump appointee, and how is that going to possibly destroy everything?
Well, the rumblings right now are about Anthony Kennedy, because he's not really a liberal or a conservative. He's the swing vote. When it's 5-4, either way, he's usually the one who swung the decision to the right or to the left. There's some rumors that he wants to retire. From what I understand, Ruth Bader Ginsburg is personally lobbying him, saying, hold on for just a few more years. You've been at this for a while. Hold on for just a little while longer. Get somebody sane or rational in there first. I have no idea what's going to go with that. Although one piece of good news is that I guess Donald Trump has been personally lobbying Anthony Kennedy to retire. And every time Donald Trump tries to lobby for something, the opposite usually happens. When he tried to whip votes for the Trump care bill in the House, they went from like 30 opposed to 50 opposed after Donald Trump was done talking to him. So I have no idea how that's going to go, but the longer Trump actually tries to take an active part, the better it is for all of us.
Well, that's good.
Yeah,
because that makes me nervous. The idea of him having another appointee is nerve-wracking. But, yeah, I mean, if Ruth Bader Ginsburg is lobbying you to stick around with her, that means
she's older than
she's
him,
not
too,
planning.
So, you know.
I know, and she's not planning to step down anytime soon either, which I'm grateful for. May the gods give her long health.
She genuinely loves her job. She loves being a Supreme Court Justice. So.
And she's good at it. She's really good at it. We need more like her. Although not under this administration.
She was picked for the Supreme Court during Bill Clinton's term by Hillary Clinton. She was Hillary's choice. So, you know, again, if you run into any of your any of your whiners who are talking about like, oh, Hillary was bad, it's like, yeah, but you know what? Take a look at who she picked for the Supreme Court and who Trump picked, and tell me if you feel good about voting for Jill Stein now. Okay?
Yeah, well, I mean, I've had that. I have beaten that dead horse as well. I'm trying, and it's difficult to move on sometimes. I mean, I know we have to. We've got to rally together. We've got to band together and push forward because nothing, you know, bitching about it isn't going to change what reality is right now. So I wish, but we've got to move forward. So that's
I got to tell you one thing, though.
What's that?
I've had plenty of people who were like libertarians and they voted green who have come to me and said, you know what, this is really a disaster. I'm not going to make that mistake next time. And to those people, I say, yes, let's move forward. But to the people who are still going on flogging the dead horse of, oh, Hillary was a crook, she was a liar, it's good that she's not in office. To these people, I'm like, grow the fuck up. You know, it's like, because it's like, it's one thing, making a mistake is one thing. If you admit that you make a mistake and you can move on, that's a very evolved thing to do. But when you've basically stuck your dick in a light socket and gotten the hair fried off your balls and you keep looking for light sockets with your dick out, I'm sorry. Somebody needs to slap you upside the head and say, hey, wake the fuck up. You know, that's the one thing, because there's a certain amount of what I call them the purity ball people who are desperately trying to find reasons why all of the powerful women in the Democratic Party are somehow bad. It's like, oh, we lost a special election. We got to get rid of Nancy Pelosi. Bullshit. Nancy Pelosi knows her shit. She's been keeping the Democratic caucus in the House absolutely 100% together. She has had no defections. None of them have voted positively on these horrible Republican bills. She has created a caucus with discipline and focus who knows what the hell they're doing. She fought like hell for a public option during the Obamacare debates. I mean, she is a very together, very capable legislative leader. I wouldn't want her to run for president, but as far as the next Speaker of the House, fuck yeah. But, you know, it's like, but anytime you get a woman in the Democratic Party achieving a certain degree of power, there's always these people who are going to be like, oh, well, all the Republicans say these mean things about her. Maybe we should dump her. And they don't say the same thing about the guys that all these Republicans say mean things about. So it's like, you know what? We've got to be able to move on. We've got to be able to rally together. But if you've got people out there who are basically planning on blowing shit up next time, if just because somebody is only 99% progressive and not 100% progressive, you know, these people have learned jack shit from what happened last year, and they deserve to, you know, have the riot act read to them. I'm sorry. I mean, I have some people very close to me who are still in the clueless area. And, you know, it's one thing to say, okay, we're not going to talk politics when we're hanging out, you know, around a fire, having a few beers. But when I see these people saying stupid shit on social media, I will still speak up, because it's like, listen, we've got to learn our lessons from the last time. We can't keep doing the same thing and expecting a different result. Because we have to evolve. We're liberals. We believe in evolution. We have to let it happen to us. So that's, you know, that's what I'm saying. And I'm just waiting. I mean, I've already heard some people starting to talk smack about Elizabeth Warren. Do not talk smack about my Lizzie around me, okay? This woman is a fucking dynamo.
I know. She is. She's a warrior. She's a true warrior. In, like, every sense of the word. She's amazing.
Hell, let's have Kamala Harris, Elizabeth Warren 2020, the prosecutor and the lawyer. There you go.
I love it. That sounds beautiful. I wish it could get traction. I hope it does. I hope it's something they both want in the future. Because because every time someone asks Elizabeth Warren, she's like, I'm very happy as a senator. I'm very happy with what I'm doing. This is how I am serving. And it's like, but we want you and need you to do more. I'm sorry. I know we already asked the world of this woman, and we still want more. It's unbelievable. She is such a dynamo. She is an incredible powerhouse, and I love her. I love her so much.
I love seeing her being interviewed on the Rachel Maddow show, because she really just opens up, and she's an incredible communicator. So
yeah,
that's just one of the things that's so much fun about that.
Very true. I love her. I think she's fantastic. I also listen to and watch Joy Reid on her AM Joy show on Saturdays and Sundays. She's fantastic too.
Joy rocks.
Joy is amazing. She takes no prisoners, man. I'll tell you what. She does not suffer fools gladly, and she will call out pastors. I've watched her do it, calling out, you know, pastors, preachers, the whole nine yards.
Oh yeah.
She's amazing.
Oh yeah.
She's just amazing, and she has Maxine Waters on at least a couple of times a month, who I love as well. Maxine Waters.
Oh, Maxine's awesome.
I,
she is, somebody who actually will step up on camera and say, the president's a liar. There's no other way to say it. These are the words. These are the actual words. He is an actual liar. I am not pussyfooting around with this. This is what it is. And I just love people who will, and I don't even have to agree with you, but if you can sit there in front of a camera and say it, and I know you're saying it from your heart and you believe what you're saying, that
right.
to me is a real person. That's what got me about John McCain many, many years ago when I was a kind of a McCain girl, because even though I didn't agree with everything he was saying, I believed that his heart was trying to be in the right place and that he believed what he was saying. So that, you know, when you can communicate and I can feel it from your heart, this is what you really believe, that says a lot to me. And I have a lot of faith in people who are able to do that. So I'm sorry. Go ahead. You got plenty of time. We've got another 40.
Another guy to watch, especially on Twitter, is Ted Lieu, representative from Hawaii. This guy
Ted
tears Lieu. It up. Yeah.
He's amazing. Ted Lieu is the deal. I like Ted Lieu.
He is absolutely tearing it up. So, you know, let's see a Ted Lieu George Takei ticket. There you go. But
Uncle George, do you think he would actually run?
I don't think so. But the Asian and the Gaysian, that would just be an ultimate. That would be an ultimate good time right there. And that, I mean, as a matter of fact, he kind of teased us on April Fool's Day, saying that he was going to file to run against Daryl Isaac.
I remember that. I actually bought into it. I have to tell you, my starry-eyed self said that would be wonderful, and then it wound up being a joke, and I was so disappointed.
Oh, I know. Damn it, Sulu. Anyway.
I've turned into a politics geek. I can't help it. It's gotten in my blood. You know, when I was a kid, musicians were my rock stars. Now politicians are. It's amazing the changeover when you get older. It's incredible.
Oh, my God.
It's so important. I mean, all of these things are really consequential. And, you know, if I had realized this when I was younger, I would have had more time to be more active and more involved. You know, my activism didn't start until I was in my 40s. So I'm way behind on the curve. You know, I'm trying to make up for a lot of lost time, and I'm trying to encourage people. And I have these conversations with friends of mine at my day job, and you know, they're like, keep us motivated, you know, keep talking to us about what we need to do. And I have these conversations, and, you know, when I see a younger person just, you know, big-eyed and wanting to know, where do we go next? What do we do next? Help us find the way. I love that, because that's the part of the optimism that keeps me going when I feel like, holy shit, North Korea is about to blow everybody up, because that scares the hell out of me. Speaking of which, is there a possibility of getting that tamp down, getting a lid on that situation? Because that just seems to be sort of escalating.
Yeah, that is a difficult thing. When they were doing the transition, Barack Obama pulled Trump aside and said, listen, the biggest problem you're going to have in your first term is North Korea. He just came right out and said it. There are multiple things that we could do about North Korea. None of them are good. Ultimately, the best track is going to be seen if China wants to get involved in creating a solution, but they're not really crazy about getting too involved in that either. But then again, China also doesn't want to see a war happen, because then they're going to have millions of refugees flooding over the border between North Korea and China, which would be another headache that China doesn't want. So the whole thing is ridiculously unstable right now. And it's really not a great time to have virtually no State Department. But that's where we're at, because Trump is hollowing out the State Department, mainly because Vladimir Putin doesn't want the U.S. to really have any diplomatic muscle. So that's one of the quid pro quo things that Trump has been doing since Putin helped him so much, is basically trying to hollow at the State Department. Rex Tillerson, you never hear him talk because he's never really doing anything.
Right.
And, you know, Donald Trump has pretty much outsourced the military decisions to the military. And let me tell you, if you've ever watched the movie 13 Days with Kevin Costner about the Cuban Missile Crisis, you'll realize why you don't necessarily want the general setting policy, because there are generals who – there were generals that wanted to nuke Cuba during the Cuban Missile Crisis, which definitely would have started a nuclear war. But it's just, and it's, you know, there's a lot of choices that we could make. Pretty much all of them are bad. It's just not an easy thing. You know, the one of the things that they should probably work on more is cyber attacks against North Korea, because as their weapons get more sophisticated, so are the ways that they control those weapons. Like, for example, when the U.S. was doing cyber warfare against Iran's nuclear program, we got a virus into one of their computer systems that basically caused the centrifuges they were using to enrich uranium to spin so fast that they destroyed themselves and set the Iranian program back years. You know, they could try stuff like that. But one of the problems with North Korea is that they've got such a huge conventional military force. They and half of South Korea's population is within 30 miles of the border between North and South Korea. They're around the area of Seoul. So if North Korea, if hostilities broke out, North Korea could kill hundreds of thousands of people in South Korea and Japan, including U.S. soldiers, really quickly. I mean, Japan would have a 10-minute warning that conventional missiles were headed towards Tokyo. So there's, you know, there's, you know, really one of the things that needs to happen is there needs to be really robust intelligence coming out of North Korea. They've really got to step up their game between the NSA and the CIA and the Army Intel and Navy Intel and all that. They've really got to step that stuff up. And they've really got to try to pressure China to cut off the pipeline, because really the only reason why North Korea hasn't descended into anarchy is because China is keeping them afloat with food and fuel shipments, because nobody else in the world will give them anything. Really, it's going to be, if you want to avoid war, you've got to have a combination of good intel and good diplomacy. And this is something that Donald Trump doesn't have either way. So that's another thing that could wind up causing Mike Pence and the cabinet to pull 25th Amendment, because even though Pence is an asshole, he at least understands that you need to have good intel and good diplomacy. The guy's an establishment Republican. So that, you know, if the congressional leadership starts to lean on Mike Pence saying, you got to do something because we can't, you know, we don't have the will to do it, then things could get very interesting very quickly.
Oof. Boy, that's nerve-wracking right there.
Yeah. At least one thing you can say is that most of the missiles that North Korea is trying to build are ones that your average F-16 could blow out of the air. So we've got, you know, there is one side of that massive military budget that we're well-equipped to blow Russian nukes out of the air. And if we can blow Russian nukes out of the air, blowing North Korean nukes out of the air is a little simpler. So there's that.
Well, I guess that's a plus. I mean, I really hope it doesn't come to that. But okay, I guess there's sort of an upside a little bit that we can protect ourselves to a certain extent. That's good to know. So before we run out of time, and we have like about a half hour left.
Sure.
I didn't want to forget about Starwood, and I didn't want to forget about your workshop and other stuff that you're doing. What? Tell me some other stuff.
Well, I am going to Starwood. It's next week. I will be leaving on Tuesday. I'll get there sometime Tuesday afternoon. I'm doing a Russiagate workshop. That'll be on Thursday afternoon. I'm also on Wednesday afternoon, I'm going to be doing a workshop called Things That Go Bump in the Night, an introduction to the paranormal and the occult. So that's going to be fun. Those are my two workshops this year. I'm also Thursday morning at my campsite, I'm going to be hosting a tarot and coffee confab, where I'm going to have my French press coffee pot, and I'm going to encourage people to bring their favorite coffee and their favorite tarot deck, and we're going to hang out and get caffeinated and talk shop, talk tarot, cards and reading and all that fun stuff. So
that sounds awesome.
I'm also, my wife, Willow, she's going to be giving two workshops. One is Introduction to the Dumbek and to Middle Eastern Rhythms, and the other one is going to be Intermediate Dumbek playing and rhythms, and those will be on, I think, Wednesday and Friday. And you may even see us up on the main stage. We're talking about doing a bardic set, and Willow may wind up jamming with some of the bands that are coming. So there's the Jim Miller band's coming, doing their Grateful Dead set, and I'm just looking. The ADF is going to be there. The archdruid of the ADF is going to be there, John Drum. He is a great guy. And his wife, Rhiannon, is extremely cool. I got to hang out with them at Wellspring. So I'm hoping anybody out there who's listening, come on down to Starwood. If you want to stop by my campsite, I'm camped across from the stage. I'm really close to Ian Corrigan's site, which is one of the social hubs of the festival. And I'm going to have a small rainbow flag. A small rainbow flag flying from my Easy Up. So you'll be able to tell the campsite, not only by hearing my boisterous voice, but also the rainbow flag coming off the Easy Up, and we're across from the stage. And anybody who wants to come over and hang with us while we're watching the concerts at night, we usually have a really good seat for the show. So.
Oh, yeah. I've been there. It's awesome.
And now you need to come back. You need to come back next year. You got to come to Asteria and experience a Starwood at the new site. And come and hang. I'm doing Starwood Radio. I mean.
I dream about coming and doing the show from there on the Friday night that everybody's there. So that would be great.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, this year I am going to be appearing at the Mystic South Conference, which is 2 weeks from now. So I am also doing, this is more of a conference than a festival per se. So where I'm going in Atlanta, we will also have workshops, and we're going to have a lot of great speakers throughout the day is playing. So we've got a lot of stuff going on too. Yeah, so we're pretty excited.
I love throughout the day.
They're fantastic. They're amazing.
And they're great people too.
They are. They played at the Piedmont Pagan Pride Day, not this past year, I think the year before, and they were fantastic, and so I'm really looking forward to it. So that's in 2 weeks, so I'm actually going to be, you guys will be coming back from Starwood, and I'll be about to take off to the Mystic South Conference in Atlanta, so... Speaking of Mystic South, mystic-south.com, if you want to find out the list of speakers who are going to be there, the featured speakers, we have a lot of great people. Dorothy Morrison will be there. Byron Ballard will be there. Katrina Messenger is going to be there. John Beckett will be there. A lot of great people are going to be there. And I'm doing the show live from there on that Friday night. So
awesome.
Pretty excited. Yes, I'm pretty excited about that. But yes, one of these years when I have more money than wishes, I would like to do both back to back. I'll, go from Starwood in Ohio and travel back down past my house along the way and continue on to Atlanta, because this is the first one. This is the inaugural Mystic South Conference. So we're really excited about it, and we're looking at it as a every year thing, just like all of our other wonderful events. So that's exciting.
Well, this is This is the 37th Starwood Festival that's happening next week. And I'm just going to have to get together with my friends in the Chameleon Club and just see if we can just try to book you as a speaker, then you'll have to come.
I would gladly. I would love that. Absolutely. Oh, and you'll have to come down and do Mystic South at some point.
There you go. And I'm going to be doing Starwood Radio again this year. I'm going to do 3 shows on Starwood Radio. One of them is my yearly Starwood Rock Show, where I'm doing the best hard rock and heavy metal music you're going to hear at a festival.
Yes.
I'm also going to do a pop music show. I'm going to try to get my daughter to come and help me do the pop music show. And then I'm also planning on doing a show about the best of Broadway. So my wife's not too excited about that, but I know plenty of people at the festival who are going to love a show of nothing but songs from Broadway musicals. But
wow, that's awesome. That's really awesome. Yeah. And I understand Willow's feeling about that. But I do get it. And I think a lot of people would have a lot of fun with that. Starwood Radio is always a good time. You did Starwood Radio when I was there. It was fantastic.
Oh, I do it every year. In fact, this year, my son Anakin, who is 13, is going to do his own solo show.
Really?
So, yes. He is going to have his own 2-hour time slot, and he's going to play lots of, like, Avenged Sevenfold and Marilyn Manson and Motley Crue and all that fun stuff.
Cool. Very cool. Oh, my God, they've grown. Anya and Anakin are just so big now.
Yeah, Anya's 11 and Anakin's 13. He's going to be 14 next month.
Ah, stop it. I remember when he was tiny. Shush. Stop making me feel old, damn you.
He's getting taller than his mom. So
that's what happens.
A little thing
when
I was thinking of recently.
Here's
2 things that are going to make everybody around our age feel old. Okay, first, number one, next year is 2018. That means the people who turn 18 next year didn't live a single minute in the 20th century. And this year is the 30th anniversary of Guns N' Roses' Appetite for Destruction.
Oh, shit.
Yeah. Yes.
I needed that reminder of my ever-impending death. Thank you so much.
And next year is going to be the 40th anniversary of the first Van Halen album.
God.
You know what? You know what? When I go to Starwood, I hang out with my friends. And, I mean, you know, it's like Ian Corrigan last year was talking about how he started doing Starwood in his 20s. And now he's doing Starwood in his 60s and how the experience of the festival has changed. But you know what? I'm hanging around people in their 50s, 60s, even their 70s. These people are still partying. These people are still going strong. These people are still staying up until 4 and 5 in the morning. In fact, when I was shooting Dark of Moon and we were doing our shooting weekend at Tradara, we shot all day Saturday, then we had a party Saturday night, and then we shot all day Sunday. Well, all of the 19 to 25-year-olds in the cast were out cold, passed out by 11 o'clock at night, whereas all of us 40, 50, 60-somethings, we were up partying until 5 a.m. So,
what year
was
that the year that I was there? Was that 2011?
2011, that was the year that I brought Dark of Moon to Starwood,
Yes, yes, yes. That was great. That was a great year. That was a great year.
Yeah. we're having more good. In fact, you know what they're having? You're going to hate yourself for missing this. This year at Starwood, we are doing the Rocky Horror Picture Show.
Oh, stop it. Really?
Yes, we are doing it in the Puffer Dome. People are bringing their rice and their newspapers and their squirt guns. I'm going to bring my leather jacket because I got to be Eddie. And I'm going to take both of my kids down, and they're going to experience Rocky Horror for the first time.
Oh, no, virgins. Oh, this is going to be hysterical. I am sorry I'm missing this. You are so right.
And it's great because we could advertise the hell out of this because the folks from Ace actually paid money to have an authorized screening at Starwood. So we're advertising the hell out of this. We're going to have everybody come out and do the time warp.
Awesome. That sounds like a lot of fun.
You know what? I can't wait. I can't wait to tell people at future festivals that I saw Rocky Horror with Ivan Stang. I mean, come on. How many people get to say that? So
very few. Very few.
I mean, Ivan Stang and Oberon Zell. I got to make sure these guys stay up to come out to do the Midnight Rocky Horror showing at the Puffer Dome, just because that will just be epic.
It would be. I want video. I need evidence.
Well, I'm going to try to take a few more pictures this year. In fact, one thing I want to do is I'm going to take my tablet. I'm going to take a picture of anybody in my workshop audiences who want to be in the official picture. And I'm going to be posting from the cafe, or if I don't get around to posting from the cafe, I'll post a shit ton of pictures once I get home. But I'm going to try to take more pictures this year and not just rely on other people's Starwood memories.
I understand. So, was there anything else you wanted to talk about, or do you want to wrap it up for the evening?
Well, you know what? I think I've hit the high points. I mean, 5 minutes after we're done, there'll probably be a story hitting the wires that'll change everything. I think we're good. I think we can wrap it up and see everybody. Same bat time, same bat station next month. Looking forward to co-hosting. This is fun.
Yep. Love it. Love it. Thank you so much, Taliesin, for talking me off the ledge like you always do.
You know I'll always do it. So there
I
you go.
Do. I appreciate it. Love you a bunch, buddy. Thank you again.
Okay, and to everybody out there in internet land, keep banging the rocks together, guys. Catch you later.
All right. Okay, everybody, I'm going to wrap it up. Sis and I will be back next week with David Salisbury. Very much looking forward to speaking with him. Have a wonderful night. Bright blessings to all. Good night.